CEOs Speak is an exclusive Bitbeam podcast series featuring interviews of hundreds of skilled and talented CEOs who share their strategies for leading some of the country's most successful companies. Join Charlie Katz, our executive extraordinaire, as he uncovers the heart and soul of today's business leaders.
And so today we have with us Erdin Veshimov, the multitasking, I will say. He's an educator at MIT. He started the MIT Entrepreneur Bootcamp, which we're going to explore. He started a number of companies. He's multifaceted, I guess, is the way to put it. He's a philosopher and educator. He's smart in technology. And these facets have seemed to come together in very, very interesting and unique ways. I'm sure that the listeners will want to hear about that. Let me get started with this. My philosophy, if I can call it that, I never did until I'm speaking to you, but my philosophy is that the CEO is the one who makes a company. So I always like to understand the CEO before I explore the company. I like to get beneath his mask and see where the connection is. So my first question to you is, seeing where you are today and going back to youth, and youth, I mean grade school, and I'm not sure what they're called in your country. You're from the Soviet Union, a particular country that I'm not going to try and pronounce. Could you pronounce it for me?
Yeah, it's Kyrgyzstan.
Kyrgyzstan. Okay. I didn't want to make a mistake and embarrass myself. Kyrgyzstan, sometimes what they call it, a great school. But if you look back at that period of your life, and now you look at yourself today, do you see a continuity? There's some aspect of your life that either inspired you, motivated you, but you see a connection?
I'm thinking about your question. It's not a question that I've been asked perhaps in a while. Yeah, I see a connection. When you asked that question, I actually began thinking about my grade school teacher. Her name was Galina Nikitichna. And we had our elementary school in two shifts. So there was a morning shift and there was an evening shift. And that's just because there was so many kids. You had to have several shifts in the school. In fact, there were three shifts at the time. And so my mom and dad both worked. It take them quite a while to commute. So oftentimes my parents would be running late. And so Galina Nikitichna, I was in the evening shift. After the school ended and my parents went there, she would take me home with her, so that my parents could pick me up from her home. And she would, I remember those days. I remember sitting in her home, and I remember her mother there, who was an elderly woman. And I never felt like I was a burden to my teacher. I mean, think about it. She's a teacher. She has her own life, and suddenly there is this kid whose parents didn't show up. Mm. And she takes him home, and she would give me dinner. She would give me Russian soup that, we called borscht, which is delicious. And it was, I never felt uncomfortable in her home, in her presence. And I think that's what an educator can do, right? It creates comfort, belonging.
You're under the Soviet rule at that time. What I'm just trying to get a picture of education in that period. What was the focus of the education? In other words, from my understanding as a Westerner, there was a lot of barriers that they had to the individual cultures and so on. So when you're talking about your teacher, doesn't it sense that she represent the caring, the nurturing of your culture? Was that part of what she was taking care of you, because you were part of her unit, you were part of her culture, and your culture is sensitive and responsive to each other?
You know, I wouldn't say so. I would say that was her.
It was her.
And of course, there is a lot of warmth in our culture. But I think it was her. I think it was her character, personality.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what at that time, was anything that inspired you to where you are today? Any experience or the DNA of your family that now you look back and you see a connection? Or did it all evolve totally later on in your life?
Oh, at the time, it was nearly impossible for me to imagine that I would be living in Boston, Massachusetts, United States, right? At the time, this was still the faraway enemy empire, right? But I think life in the Soviet Union prepared people for one important condition that is ever present in the world. People in the more affluent countries in the world, they're shielded from this essential condition, but it's ever present, and that is uncertainty. Life is full of uncertainty. And people in the Soviet Union got a full measure of it, which was the collapse of our country. And that was a holistic collapse. Our politics, society, norms, the economy all collapsed. And I'm very grateful for that time. And I would say that a belief formed in my mind that education has to be about teaching people to deal with uncertainty.
Well, we have an expression, and I'm sure you have something similar, adversity is the best teacher. I mean, you know, the challenges of life is how you learn, not the comforts of life is how you learn. How did you move from your country to America? How did you get into America? What propelled you even to want to come? It's easy to answer that, but still, you're in your own culture, you're comfortable, you're familiar. I'm sure there were opportunities here in education. Why did you want to come to America?
I wanted to come to America since fall 1986. I was 6 years old at the time. And 1986 was the beginning of a period in the history of the Soviet Union called Perestroika. This was really the beginning of the end.
Right.
And it was a period of reformation initiated by Mikhail Gorbachev. And what that meant was also an element of cultural openness. We were allowed more cultural influence from the outside. And in particular, you'd be amazed, We had a big building in the center of our town called Dom Officerov, the House of Officers, which was a military building. It was a beautiful building, and it had a big theater hall. And in the theater hall, they organized an exhibition of American television. So we came there, and they showed Tom and Jerry. I've never seen anything like it. And we had grown-ups and children, and I saw grown-ups laughing like they've never laughed before. And, you know, as a kid, you're really processing that stuff in kid terms. But I had an intuition. Wow. A society that produced that kind of humor, I want to experience.
Interesting. Interesting.
And then it was really a sequence of a combination of luck and hard work. I benefited from some very important serendipity in my life. People of generous hearts who helped me, wrote recommendations, inspired me, told me that I could do something. And then just a good measure of hard work.
You went to the American school we're in Central Russia, in Central Asia. You went to American school. What brought you to that school? Was there that already you were committed to coming to America? You wanted to know the culture more? Why that particular school?
That was the 1990s, and trying to become a part of what's American was very exciting to people, and actually for good reasons. Unfortunately, in the 1990s, and that was several years into the Soviet Union disappearing, a lot of corruption began occurring in Kyrgyzstan, in particular in education. And Charlie, you might be surprised, but I'm not kidding you. In many of our universities, teachers were collecting bribes and giving grades to students in return, right? That did not exist at the American university. And that's why I wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to be a part of something that's honest. And the same goes for a lot of the kids in my class. And
I want to ask this question throughout to the different stages as we go further in your life. But at that period, how did you adjust to the American culture? And you know, it is very vastly, I live in New York. I've come to contact with quite a number of Soviet country immigrants. And there is, I wouldn't call it a chasm, but look, they have their own culture, their way of looking at things and understanding things. How did you find the, how did you adapt? How easy was it to adapt?
You know, when you began asking this question, my instinctive response was to say, well, it was very easy to adapt to the American culture. But then I stopped myself to really reflect on it. And I realized in the beginning it wasn't so easy. What helped me was I won a fellowship at the end of high school to attend an American high school. And it was a fellowship by the U.S. government. It was called the Freedom Support Act. Great, great name. And it was intended for kids from the former Soviet Union to come and experience life in America. So I won a fellowship to live with an American family and come to an American high school. I went to a small town in Indiana called Aurora, Indiana. And in the beginning when I went, I didn't speak any English. I didn't understand what was happening. And in Kyrgyzstan, we have a tradition. It's, you know, it's a fighting culture. So when you change schools on day one, you're going to fight some boy because the goal is to decide your pecking order, you know, how tough you are, how good you are. You know, it seems crazy, but it was very normal to us. And so I was very surprised when I came to the American high school. I said, well, you know, I'm coming here. I'm going to have to fight today. That was my day one at the high school. And I was very surprised that no one kind of took me aside and said, you know, let's go. We need to settle the score here. And I said, well, maybe it's going to happen tomorrow. So for a week, I wondered when the moment is going to come, and it never did. That was the strangest thing to me. But,
you know, coming to America, obviously America and the freedom is very inviting and attractive. But is there any sense of leaving some of yourself behind? And maybe family, and maybe culture, and maybe values that are different.
Oh, for sure. And you feel this dilemma. You feel this dilemma. One thing that was quite shocking for me, as someone who came from Central Asia, we have, for lack of a better word, a much more patriarchal culture. For example, Charlie, you're older than me. In Kyrgyzstan, I would never just call you Charlie. It would be highly disrespectful. I would call you Charlie Baike, Charlie Bai, and that would be a sign of respect. And I was just amazed in America that people would call each other by their first name, right? So, and even though that sounds simple, it really does take some getting used to. And it takes some personality transformation to actually be very comfortable with that and to see each other as equals. That was a big aspect of it. But yeah, you do feel like that you lose something. And it's a question inside of you, you know, you're letting go of something, for sure.
Yeah. At what point in your life did you come to America? How old were you?
So when I won the fellowship, I was 17. I was 17. Then I left a year after and came back when I was 24.
Did your parents find it difficult to say goodbye to their favorite son?
You know, they wanted me to go to America. They wanted me to go because they saw it as a land of opportunity. That, hey, you know, it doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter who you are. They really saw America, this place that anyone can be successful.
So you came in 17 and you entered, where did you go into? I know you went to Harvard, but where did you go at that point?
So when I was 17, I went to just a high school in the United States. Then I went back to Kyrgyzstan. I studied for a period of time at the American University back home. Then I went to college in England, and I came back to America for graduate school. And yeah, you're right. I went to Harvard.
Where in England did you go to college? Which college?
I went to a great school called the University of Bradford. It's up north in Yorkshire. And I studied peace studies.
You studied what?
peace studies. So, generally, such departments are known as war studies. But the founders of our department said, hey, if you want to create peace, isn't language important? Shouldn't you call them peace studies? Because that's your goal. And I agree with them.
England is a very different culture than America. You know, Churchill said, England and America are two countries separated by the same language. So it was there some adaption that you had to do to the English culture? They have more of a class system. They don't have that liberal American attitude as much and so on. Was there another adaption that you had to do or finding your bearings in that culture?
Oh, for sure, in one way or the other. But I have remarkable memories of England. It's a unique country. It has some, I find that in England, there is a sense of fairness that is very deep in people. It's a very fair country. It's a very fair people, I find, in my experience. And, I've always respected that and felt home with it. And even though, of course, it's a different culture, you have to get used to it. But that's okay. That's okay. That's life in the modern world.
And my understanding, I've been there many times, but that it's not as aggressively or relentlessly seeking, for success. I think there's a moderation in English life that we could probably use in America. I don't think they're as consumer focused as we are. That's my impression, but I may be wrong. Be more tempered in that respect.
Yeah. I don't know. I've not thought about this aspect of it. I'll think about it some more.
Okay. So you come to America and you go to Harvard. You went on a scholarship?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. I wouldn't have been able to go without it.
And you went, what were you taking? What was your major?
So Harvard has one remarkable program called RECA. It's called Regional Studies, and it's for Russia, Eastern Europe, and Central Asia. And it used to be a program at Harvard that trained a lot of American diplomatic corps, people who ended up going into the CIA, people who would interact with the Soviet Union and needed to be prepared for it. So that's a program that I attended.
And what happened to your dream to be part of the CIA?
that was never an option.
And then you'd be up against KGB, and it would be interesting, though. How many years did you spend at Harvard?
2 years.
2 years. In all these years of going to the different schools and different cultures, did you feel any barrier? Did you feel that just coming from a foreign country, from the Soviet Union, that was there any resistance in accepting you in circles that you want to be part of? Not necessarily because it was racist or anything like that, just simply you're different. Did you ever have a sense of that?
Yeah, of course. And it takes a while to shake this off. You know, consider the psychology of a kid who comes to the United States, to Harvard from Kyrgyzstan. And the reality is, yeah, people at Harvard know what Kyrgyzstan is, but in general, people in the world do not. So you come from a country that no one really knows about, right? And it's a difficult thought for a lot of people to imagine if you come from a more well-known country, right? You're starting from a foundation of weakness. And I call it such because that's how I saw it. And that's not necessarily how others viewed it, but it was my mindset. And so you do have a little bit of an insecurity, and it takes a while to shake this off. I have to say, yeah, that was the case. That was the case.
You mentioned in our interview something totally fascinating, and I'd like to explain it from your perspective. You came home one day, and you had the highest grade. You had a 5, which is the highest grade. And you told your mother, and you expected her to give you great praise. And she didn't, and she said to you, that's not enough. You need a 6, which did not exist. And you asked her why, and she says, because people like us need a 6. What did she mean by that, and what did you take from that?
Oh, that was a very important moment in my life. It's actually one of my earliest memories sometimes you have moments in life where you realize, okay, it's for real now. And you have this sense of gravitas, internal gravitas, for lack of a better word. And what my mom meant by that, we were Kyrgyz. We are an ethnic group now. We are the majority in Kyrgyz, and we have been during the times of the Soviet Union. But, you know, the Soviet Union, it had its faults. It's had good parts. But at the time, if you weren't Russian, it was very difficult for you to achieve success in a stellar success that meets your potential in the country. In a lot of areas, you wanted to be Russian. That was just reality. Nothing against Russian people. I mean, wonderful people. I have many friends, but that was just the system. And so for you to be able to make something of yourself, you just had to strive harder. And I'm grateful to my mom for conveying that without coddling me or shielding me from that. She told me how it is. And you know what? I accepted it.
And have you found that to be an inner drive that you still have, the desire to be a six? Rather than a five, is that still driving you?
You could say that. The thing is, right? You ask very deep questions, and it's hard to reflect on them because some things become very natural to you. But you know, I think I could make the argument that I do have a general dissatisfaction with anything I do. It is hard for me to be perfectly content, and all of my friends and colleagues know that. Very difficult for me. You know, sometimes we do something great and I feel great in that moment, but literally the next moment I'm already kind of processing and being self-critical and self-demanding. Maybe that habit of mind was created at the time. It's possible.
From Harvard, you went to MIT. Well, you started a company. You started a couple of companies. Does that happen when you left Harvard?
At first, my intention was to get a doctorate and become a professor. But during my time in Harvard, just this interest fizzled out. I had a sense that, I had an interesting sense that, you know, academia was not engaging with questions that were real, at least in my perception at the time. And I said, you know what, that's not for me. I went to my advisor, Tim Colton, who was the head of the government department at Harvard at the time. And I said, Tim, that's how I'm feeling. And I had trepidation in advance of that meeting, but he said, if that's what you're feeling, you should go and kind of do something else. That's great. It's great that you're feeling this way. And then by sheer luck, I got a job at a startup. Which was given to me by the founder and CEO of the company, Jenny Florin, wonderful person, just one of the angels in my life. You know, she gave me a job and she said, "Hey, I like you. Join the company. I don't know what you'll do, but we'll figure it out." Right? And it doesn't happen very often that people do this for you. She also helped me get a worker's visa, which is why I was able to stay in the United States. And then after I worked at her company for a couple of years, I said, you know what, entrepreneurship is what I want to do. And that meant that it might be a good idea to go to MIT. And that's what I did.
In an entrepreneurship program, when you went to MIT?
Yeah, I went to the business school at MIT, to MIT Sloan. And then what happens is you come to MIT and it's impossible not to get involved in entrepreneurship.
And you've been here at MIT for quite some time.
I have. I graduated from MIT, co-founded a company, then I worked at a venture firm, and then something spectacular happened in the world. 2012 was announced as the year of the MOOC, the year of the massive open online course. New platforms were established at the time, Coursera, Udacity, MIT and Harvard established edX. And really, you had to look at that stuff through the lens of a kid who grew up in Kyrgyzstan. If somebody told me in Kyrgyzstan, hey, Erdin, you can take a course from MIT or Harvard for free online, I would have said you are crazy. That's impossible. And so when that became possible, I just knew it was going to change the world. I knew I had to be a part of it. And I just hustled my way back into MIT to be a part of it.
There's a statement you made, but I want to save it, but I just want to touch upon it, you know, the paradox of progress. Before we get into that, which I want to reserve, is there a philosophical instinct within yourself? You know, early on, I defined you as a philosopher. Are you?
I don't know. I really don't know. You know, what does a philosopher do? Does a philosopher think about the meaning of life? Does the philosopher contemplate something that is intangible? Perhaps I do engage in those questions, but I wouldn't say professionally. So I don't know. It'll be for others to judge many years from now.
Part of the reason I'm asking is I'm still trying to trace down what is part of you today that is part of your the culture of your native country. In other words, I can't imagine that if I moved to another country, and even if I evolved, and that I still would not be American. Yeah. And it would have shaped the way I looked at things in life. And I'm just wondering if that's still, that you are still thinking a certain way based on your roots.
Yeah. I'll give you an example of that. In that case, yes, for sure. What my culture, the culture of the Kyrgyz people, they know one thing really well. And that is how to treat others with dignity. You know, my people, you know, we are quite an interesting people. We're tough fighting people. So, you know, sometimes we are not that respectful or dignified. Actually, over the last several years, there have been a number of political revolutions in my country, right? But at the core of my people, because we are nomadic people in the mountains, and what that means is that people live in quite a bit of separation from each other. Right. And so when you meet others, that's an event, that is something special. And so people have a way of treating others with respect and dignity and really the ability to put others on a pedestal. It's an amazing aspect of my culture. And it is amazing because they have an ability to put others on a pedestal without losing dignity oneself. Oftentimes, I observe in many people the apprehension of putting others on a pedestal because they feel like they diminish themselves. But what my people know, and it's an amazing secret that I wish more people knew, is that actually, when you dignify others, you dignify yourself. And that is what I carry from my roots in my life and the world today.
Very good. So let's move on to your entrepreneurship. Let's explore. Let me explain also, the Bitbean, the company that sponsored CEO Speaks, is a software consulting company that primarily, or actually only, 100% works with entrepreneurs. My background is advertising, and I worked at the Ranger Madison Avenue agencies, and I worked with different companies like Colgate and so on, you know, creating campaigns. But at the same time, I also worked on the West Coast with quite a number of entrepreneurial companies. And I'm always fascinated by entrepreneurs. I sort of study them. And part of the reason why I'm so inquisitive about yourself is I always like to understand the makeup that takes a person in a certain direction and what separates him, where that drive comes, why is he succeeding or not succeeding in comparison to others. So how do you find, and you created the bootcamp. But if I could ask you in a simple way, how would you define the heart and soul of an entrepreneur as you see it, both from yourself, perhaps, but also the people that you work with? What is an entrepreneur? You know, we use that word so easily, we throw it out. What is an entrepreneur?
An entrepreneur is a problem solver. As an entrepreneur, you're solving problems. And what entrepreneurs do, they identify problems that are unsolved, or problems that are not solved optimally. And they apply creative problem solving to solve the problem, to offer a superior solution. And then they design an organization to make that solution consistent, sustainable, and increasingly efficient. That's what they do. Entrepreneurship is problem solving.
When they go into it, are they looking forward to problems? Aren't they usually going with the idea that this will be smooth and aligned to the top?
The more experienced entrepreneurs become, the more they refine their problem-centric mindset. You know, when you approach entrepreneurs who have been down the path a number of times, you find that they tend to think very clearly about a specific problem that can be solved. And this is the necessary learning stage for all aspiring entrepreneurs, because they think on the level of ideas, right? But an idea, while it's an adjacent notion to a problem, they're not the same. And you have to be able to separate what your idea is from the underlying problem.
I interviewed a short while ago Dr. Joel Allen, who founded AccuWeather. And he told me the following, that I had a goal to get started to really launch a company. I needed 100 clients. I made 25,000 calls before I had 100 clients, which meant that I made 24,000, I got 24,900 rejections. Today they have 1.5 billion users around the world. So I think that, you know, the persistence of it, the dedication to it, I think is you've got to have that within you just to sustain, you know, and overcome. You can be focused on solving the challenges and the problems, but you have to, I think, mentally be tough enough to want to solve those problems and not walk away from it.
That's an important quality, because, you know, people are rational creatures, right? We want something that gives us, if not immediate, but tangible and visible results.
Right.
And to make 25,000 calls without a guarantee of results, that's a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, yeah, entrepreneurship is about a bit being counterintuitive to human nature.
So let's talk about bootcamp. What is it? And first of all, is it connected to MIT? Is it part of MIT, or it's associated with MIT?
The bootcamp is very much connected to MIT. It's an MIT program. I'm an MIT employee. This is my legacy, my contribution to MIT.
The word bootcamp is translated as tough, rigorous type of training. Is that what it's about, what do you mean by bootcamp?
Bootcamp is an intensive learning program. Our bootcamps focus on entrepreneurship, and really, our goal is to give people an understanding of entrepreneurship principles, but through the education and the principles, our goal is to give them confidence. We want to give them this feeling, I can do more than I thought I could. And I want every student from the bootcamp to graduate with this feeling, I can do more than I thought I could. So that's bootcamps. That's MIT bootcamps.
I'm aware. I can't quote anything right now that many, many great inventions and such have come out of MIT. I'm wondering, though, not everybody could afford to get an MIT, and not everybody has the IQ that would get them into MIT, even if they had the wallet. It is that way in the terms of trying to grow entrepreneurship and widen the circle of an entrepreneurship. Is it too limiting? In other words, and the question I'm asking you is there a reason that you don't open up this concept to a broader market and lower the standards both financially and IQ? Because not every successful entrepreneur has the stature of an MIT graduate, but at the same time, you've been extremely successful. Is there any idea or any validity in exploring it and widening it and saying, hey, there are many good people out there and they deserve to have this type of a background as well?
Yeah. You're asking questions that go to the core of the ongoing change in education. We have to redefine our standards of selection. On the one hand, selection is very important, and that's because education is not about content. Education is about communities. Your goal in an educational environment is to create a community for people. And that implies some way of selection. Now, we need to change our concept of time and the role of time in education, right? The fact that someone can do a great job on a test on 18, right? That's great. That's great. And you know, we should celebrate it, right? But the goal is not to be successful at 18. The goal is to have a long lasting, fulfilling, adventurous, happy, impactful life, right? And so the mission of universities must be transformed from people who are ready in that tiny slice of a moment in their life to actually serving people throughout their life when they experience important challenges and need new knowledge and inspiration. That's a change that needs to happen. And
you mentioned that we need 100,000 new universities. Is that even feasible?
That's not going to happen. And thank you for bringing this up. What you're referring to is the fact that we'll need to have many more universities, considering that the global population is growing. If we want to provide the growing population with higher education, we'll need many more universities. In fact, we'll need close to 100,000 new universities. Of course, that's not going to happen. How? Right. So we need innovation. We need technology. But that's not enough. We need pedagogical innovation. We need to rethink how we deliver education.
Why? Let me jump onto this. Why can't the boot camp be an online free course? And then it's open to a million people.
Well, we actually have a number of online free courses that we offer as part of the boot camp. We do that. And they allow us to build a wider community globally. But the reality is there are some things that organizations do in the provision of organizations that are costly, right? We need to hire educators. We need to hire coaches. We need to have a stable organizational team that is involved in the recruitment and selection of the students. We need to have a team that builds curricula, right? Very, very important. And the fact of the world is, well, you know, some things cost some funding. Right. And you have to think about, well, how do you provide for that? So
is it a question that universities are profit centers? In reality, unless it's a state run education center, and therefore, at the end of the day, like you're saying, it's a capitalist concept. There has to be a profit at the end of the day. Do we got to pay professors? And therefore, they won't open it up because we can't operate on a capitalist concept with free. Free and capitalism do not go together. So there'll always be that barrier in widening it, unless and I'm just throwing this out, I don't mean MIT in particular, will say that we have enough support from our total university that we could afford to do this on a free basis. We can't throw our whole program out free, then we would shut down, but we can take the other support financially from everything we're doing and, including our own supporters and then move into free. Let me ask you a question that I'm working on right now. But my background, as I said, is the creative department of advertising agencies. I've written many articles on marketing and I also give creative writing courses. I just started a course on creative thinking. Now, education, as it is in America, and I think everywhere else, which is a global issue, is the antithesis of creativity because it's a logic thinking process, 1 + 1 = 2, not 1 + 1 = 6. And you have to go from A to B to C, and you don't go from A to Z and back to T and so on. And basically, in one of the very simple reason why from a major European research is that our education, they said, is test-based. Schools could only identify the success by the marks on the test. Therefore, you're taught to get that one right answer, which is antithesis of creativity. So thinking about entrepreneurship, which requires a creative problem-solving capabilities, is like by the time they get through high school, they are so, away, the creativity now. And let me continue because George Land, who developed the Polaroid, did a IQ test, a creativity test for engineers for NASA to see whether NASA should employ them. He decided to give that same test to 15,000 children, starting at the age 5. At the age 5, something like 90-something% were creative. But at the time, that same group, which you give them the same test over the years, became adults, only 2% were creative. Same group. Because the educational process just, you know, you first of all, you have the education, you got to get the right answer. Then you go work for a company, you have to come up with the right answer. You can't look dumb. Creativity requires asking dumb questions and making false assumptions, and you wrap it around and you find it. But you can't do that if you want to hold on to your job. Where does that lead us in nurturing entrepreneurs?
Oh, I think we're approaching a fork in the road in our global society. As I shared with you before, my view of the world is one of uncertainty. The world is uncertain, and many more people are beginning to understand that. Let's speak about the United States for a moment. You know, for a long time, this country has been shielded from the effects of uncertainty, of course, on a relative scale, which has allowed people to be, let's say, a bit more playful, right? To be explorative in their life choices. That is changing now. You're right. Education is becoming expensive. It is harder and harder to get good jobs. Incomes are declining. And so my expectation is what you will see is people trying to be less and less creative. They will be going for things that are more certain, more reliable, right? But it is especially now that we need more creativity. And so I think somehow we've got to have a national conversation about creativity, because it will help us in the uncertain decades ahead. I don't have the answers, but I think you're coming to something that is very important for our country.
I imagine talking to you that you're nice when you sit around with your friends and you have these type of conversations, exploring these questions at your level. And yet being frustrated because at some point the ideas need reality, and transforming them into reality is a whole different thing. In other words, the idea, the philosophy, the concept is solid, but then the real world comes, you know, the real life steps in, and then it must be very frustrating sometimes. You sort of could identify, like you said about education, and then we're left with that problem, and we can only hope, and you know, somehow. Let me ask you. I want to get into that concept that you had, which is a paradox of progress. I can sort of understand it, but I want to hear it from how you interpret it, how you articulate it.
The paradox of progress. We're making tremendous progress in our modern society. We have things that we couldn't have before. Growing up in Kyrgyzstan in the 1980s, I never tried a banana until I was 11, right? And I didn't have an orange until I was 9, and I didn't have a Snickers bar until I was 13. There are a lot of things we didn't have. And so we're making big leaps in the comfort that a lot of people have today, in our ability to extend life. But all of it comes at the sacrifice of something else. It comes at the sacrifice of our environment. It comes at the sacrifice of the equality and egalitarianism in society. And point to me one example in the world where we've made some progress without also taking two steps back. And that's what I call paradox of progress. And, you know, I think humanity will continue going in circles unless we're able to resolve this paradox.
As an American, and you know, over my years, seeing the consumerism has really taken hold beyond any norm, I think. And I just wrote an article about it, and I pointed out something very interesting, something frightening, and something which I believe is unsolvable. America, economists identified America through the 1850s as a subsistence economy. The average person worked on a farm, most people, or he was a craftsman, a cottage industry, and he made a couple of chairs a week, a couple, and so on. Then three things happened around the same time. Sears and Montgomery Ward put out the catalogs that went out to rural areas. And people used to rough-hewn clothing and rough-hewn and, you know, furniture and that whole lifestyle. Suddenly they saw the opportunity to have upper-class type of clothing, et cetera, appliances. Macy's and Gimbel's and Montgomery Ward opened up in cities. So it opened the idea to the people that they could move up in stature to a middle class. But that was okay. But what turned the table is the Industrial Revolution. When Jonas made three chairs a week, fine. When a factory makes 3,000 chairs a week, it's a whole different issue. And they can't sit in the warehouse, right? So it created capitalism. It created the idea that we have to, I want to make a profit. I supported this venture of this factory, but I want something in return. It changed the whole context of how we look at things. In the early 1900s, there was a very good advertising agency. I forgot the name, but they had a very famous, and the owner's philosophies are still used in advertising today. But one day, his office was above a bar, and he gets a note from a former mounted policeman in the bar, and he says, "If I tell you what advertising is all about, will you give me a job?" So he liked the challenge. He said yes. He sent the note up, and the note said, "Advertising is salesmanship in print." At that time, it was in print. And he was exactly on the head. Instead of a person knocking on the door and selling you a brush, you had a radio, a magazine selling 1,000 people about the same point. But what happened was that it had to keep evolving. Say, I work in advertising. Advertising is human psychology, how you motivate people. And it's gotten better and better and better. But it has to be doing that day in and day out, because the moment it stops, you have a recession of 2008. You have the Great Depression. So we've got to be pushed again and again. And it was acknowledged by President Hoover that we got to keep pushing the envelope, his actual language in his core group about the need to keep driving people to buy, because the moment we stop. So America has become a perpetual buying machine. And because of that, it's changed our values. It's affected how we look at what we're about. We now, in the old days, when Ford came out, Henry Ford's car, he said, you can buy a car you want in any color you want as long as it's black. His Model Ts were black, and that was it. Today, and the point is, you now identify yourself, do I have an SUV, do I have this one, do I have that one? And psychologists have studied this and said it's made us less happy and so on. So my question to you is, we are embroiled and we're threaded around the world in a concept of consumerism, which is this incessant need to keep buying, driven through advertising, which I don't blame advertising, because the salesmanship on a bigger scale, but factories, you know, employ more people, so there's nothing you can shut off. Where are we headed for? I mean, we're not headed to, you talk about happiness and it's not possible, I think. Unless you have a strong, I believe, religious background or some value that gives you a temperate perspective in your own life.
It's a deep, deep insecurity that is understandable that we have as humanity. And let me explain what I mean by that. You know, millennia ago, when our ancestors were hunters and gatherers, and then later became people who lived from agriculture, right? If there is a frost and your crop goes away, your family suffers. Right. And so that insecurity, that potential of uncertainty to create ruin in your life created a deep uncertainty in us, uncertainty about the future, and therefore the instinct to accumulate. It is a self-defensive instinct, and it's naturally, understandably, and very deeply in all of us. I don't know how we transcend it. That's how
Sitting there at MIT, I think your responsibility is to solve that. Okay?
You know, problems of this kind are not just solved with the mind. They have to be solved with the heart and with the soul. So, you know, all of humanity must come to the table because we all have something to contribute.
You don't want to take on the sole responsibility.
Not that we it's true responsibility, but I really do believe it that the answers really do not just lie in our heads.
You know, unfortunately, I don't think we have the leaders today in government or elsewhere that is able to really, you know, give us a vision and raise us. But that's a different conversation. I want to thank you for it. And let me ask you two more questions. Actually, one question. Entrepreneur, the essence, what advice would you do? We have many entrepreneurs here, CEOs who listen to this. Most of them are start off as entrepreneurs and they evolve. What advice would you give them? The core advice that you found from your experience as an educator and a boot camp and so on.
Entrepreneurship is learning. Resist the popular narrative that entrepreneurs are born. All of the entrepreneurs that you see around yourself on the covers of newspapers, magazines, on television, they are the people who became who they are through small incremental steps of learning and incremental personal transformation. And you can do that too. Very important to understand that. Entrepreneurship is learning, and you can learn and you can surprise yourself by who you can become.
Let me thank you for your time. Fascinating, every aspect of your life from early on through your growth and development and where you are sitting today and all the information and knowledge you shared with us. I'm very gratified and thank you very much for your time. And I wish you continued success and we'll see you soon.
Thank you for joining Charlie Katz, our executive extraordinaire, in yet another insightful interview. Be sure to check out more stories from CEOs across the country at bitbean.com/CEOs speak to learn more about what it takes to get to the top and stay there.